Welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BPSouthside.com, the baseball prospectus local site covering the Chicago White Sox. You can find this podcast on iTunes or our Blog Talk Radio page by searching for the Catbird Speaks or also your favorite podcast app. I'm Colin Whitchurch, joined as always by the newlywed Nick Beeps, Nick Schaefer. How's it going, Nick?
It's going really great. It just occurred to me that my wedding band comes from a store called Catbird, so that seems even more appropriate.
Yeah. And we do have a special guest today. The Baseball Prospectus Midseason Top 50 Prospects was released today. We're recording this on a Thursday, so joining us, Baseball Prospectus Minor League Editor, Craig Goldstein. Hey, Craig, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I don't have anything related to Catbirds to offer you.
Have you ever been to the you know, there's a restaurant called the Catbird Seat in Nashville, and people, when our blog was previously actually called the Catbird Seat, people would tweet at the restaurant all the time.
They're like, had a great meal. That's a shame. Thanks,
you
guys
had to give that up.
Yeah, really.
That is a shame. No, I've not been to Nashville, but one day.
Yes. So let's jump right into it here. You guys have four White Sox on your newest top 50, including the number one overall prospect, Yoan Moncada. So naturally,
that's right. White Sox fans are not allowed to be mad at us.
We
now
are going to ask you about the guy you omitted, Reynaldo Lopez, number 30 on the preseason top 101, not on the midseason top 50. So, Craig, why do you hate Reynaldo Lopez and why do you hate the White Sox?
So, I mean, first of all, and it's completely fair to reference the 101. I know, you know, Jeff is having a chat right now, and he's referenced it as well. But we really did kind of rebuild this from the ground up. We don't kind of take people off the 101 and slot and move people up, that type of stuff. We just go from scratch and see where people shake out. So it's not necessarily a reflection on, like we've dropped him 20 plus spots. It's just we found other players to slot in that we liked a little bit more. I think with Lopez, the issue that you run into, and it's something that I've been yelled at about Lopez by a pro scout at this point. So White Sox fans are certainly not alone on this, but my replies to him are, he's a shorter pitcher. I mean, he's listed at right around 6 feet, 6 foot, and there's effort in his delivery, and he's got a bunch of pitches and a high octane fastball, and that's all really good. And he's still missing a ton of bats, which is great, but he's still walking a few too many guys, and he's giving up a lot of fly balls and a lot of home runs. And some of that can come down to park and the environment of the different parks he goes to, but he's going to have a tough environment when he gets to Chicago, certainly, in terms of fly balls. And beyond that, just that, I think the prospect team, and I know I feel this way, so I'm comfortable saying it, feels he's likely to be a reliever than a starter when it comes down to it. I think he can be a really, really good reliever, potentially a dominant multi-inning reliever, kind of in the mold of how Dellin Betances was used for a little bit for the Yankees. But relievers have enough variance and lose themselves enough. I mean, I just mentioned Betances, but he's walked like seven guys in his last two outings. And when you have, you know, the performance is subject to such variance that when it comes to making a list, we kind of prioritize the guys that we think can start. If you think Lopez can start, you'd have him on this list. And I would say that just comes down to a different level of confidence in whether he can start or not. And I think that's somewhat reasonable, but there are a lot of good things there, and there are some bad things that are kind of holding us back on Lopez.
Could you, just looking at the list, for example, a guy where he has some features in common, not a ton, but like a Walker Buehler, for example, is at 19.
Sure.
And he's someone where I would say, like, what are your concerns on him? And I'd be worried about him as a safe starting pitcher, for example. Is it that he hasn't shown the flaws over as big of a sample yet as Ronaldo Lopez has? Is it something with his frame or his delivery or anything like that where you feel more confident putting Buehler as high as 19?
Yeah, Buehler was a tough one. I mean, we had industry sources tell us he's the number two starting pitching prospect in the minors. So that was very compelling to us. I think basically every industry person we talked to or people that were familiar with him, like intimately familiar with him, said like his work ethic is incredible. And I don't mean that relative to Lopez. So please don't take that as any shade. It's just a comment that we received. And that like he was just an incredible, like high end worker, and he's showing, you know, four above average pitches. He's 97 to 99. I am worried about him holding up as a pitching prospect. And I went back and forth with an industry guy on this because my case for having him, I'm behind AJ Puck, behind Colby Allard, behind some of those guys. And part of the reasoning for that was I've seen, you know, we can look at and see Colby Allard is 19 and in AA and has gone six innings or more 15 times since the beginning of 2016. You can do the same with Mitch Keller, who's two spots ahead of Buehler, but he's gone six innings or more 16 times in that same time frame. Walker Buehler has thrown into the sixth once.
Jeez.
He's gone, the furthest he's thrown is five. Part of that is that's the Dodgers, right? It's not because he can't, it's because he hasn't. And so the tough part about Buehler, and I'm glad you brought him up, Nick, is this is you know, we got a lot of high end praise on Buehler. A lot last year who have seen him this year and like him. But the team does have the same concerns about whether he can start. But I guess the difference is that it's a shorter track record, which can cut both ways, but can let you say, you know, over time he's going to build up that arm strength, that depth. He has an extra pitch, I think, on Lopez, so he kind of has another tool to go through the lineup a little bit more, and his command is better. I mean, that's I guess the bigger separator between, if you're directly comparing them, is that he has better command within the zone. But you know, I think that's a very valid point, and I think it can also serve to illustrate that the gap between, you know, we talked about Lopez being, he was on versions of the list, and he's probably in that next 15 to 20 group. But the gap between 19, 20 and, you know, 70 is probably smaller than it looks like in terms of ordinal numbers.
Yeah, and there's a couple, that's something I wanted to jump to address at some point while I had you too. I mean, before moving on, yeah, it's really interesting to look through this list, and I must have been hard to. You know, you have these so many guys on this list who have such crazy stuff, like, you know, Sixto Sanchez or Walker Buehler, or from the White Sox, like Michael Kopech, and you're looking at it and you're thinking, like, you know, are these going to be, you know, how will this translate to a starter's workload? And I guess what a starter's workload is has been evolving too over the last like 4 or 5 years even. But
yeah,
versus like a Soroka or an Allard, where it's looking like, hey, this is sort of a traditional mid-rotation starter type guy who looks pretty safe.
Yeah, I mean, the other side of the argument that where we're coming from, saying that we don't know that he's a starter, and, you know, are they going to be able to hold up over X amount of innings? We'd love to see, you know, 180 to 200. Is that guys don't throw 180 to 200 as much as they used to, and that's a reality that at some point the evaluation community is going to have to kind of consider and consider changing kind of how we rank these guys. We're not at that point yet, not changing that paradigm just yet, but it is that we're going to have to grapple with at some point. And I think it's a reasonable, you know, if you're a White Sox fan and you say, you know, I'm fine with a guy throwing 150 innings rather than 180, and I'm fine with that guy being a starter, so I think Lopez has a better chance to start. Yeah, you know, I think that's not an unreasonable point of view. But it's not the one we're working from. So if you're trying to understand the list, that's if you want to disagree with it, that's certainly a separate discussion and not an unreasonable one.
And it's part of that. By that same token, there's sort of this, I think traditionally, or at least for a long time while I was growing up and learning more about baseball, that the division was between, is this guy a starter, or if he's really good and doesn't look like he's start, we'll call him a closer, you know, like a 50 to 80 innings a year guy who's mostly going to be doing one out outings. But then, you know, there's this increasing role, and maybe it's a revival of a role from the early 80s where you have like a Chris Davinsky who you just let him go like 2 to 4 innings even as this like, and that's like really cool and valuable also, especially with pitchers getting pulled sooner in games. And I'll be interested to see if that becomes like one of the phylums you start nominating guys for as the, you know, pitcher roles continue to evolve.
I think if it was more than that, I think the Astros have like 3 guys they do that with. And I don't know too many other teams that are letting guys go 3 to 4 innings at a clip. I know the Astros have done it with Peacock, a little bit with Michael Feliz, and obviously Davinsky. And there are, you know, Andrew Miller, or 1 to 2 1/3 or so. But yeah, if that was league wide, if that usage was league wide, I think we value these guys because it matters how teams are using these guys. You know, a lot of this is conceptual and theoretical, but it does matter the way in which these guys are deployed, because if we knew Reynaldo Lopez could go, you know, in the Chris Davinsky mold, and if he was in Houston and we knew that they were okay with that, we, you know, maybe it's a different situation. And you might think that's not fair. Lopez is a one inning reliever. If they turn him into Kelvin Herrera, which is again not a bad result. Kelvin Herrera is really good, but he's a one inning guy, and the gap between a potential number 4 starter who throws 180, you know, league average, maybe slightly above innings, versus a guy who throws, you know, like you said, 50 to 70 really good innings. It's really hard to make up that innings gap. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just based on leverage or whatever. And you know, you see, I do think it's interesting that Houston specifically is one of the organizations that's sort of leading the way on this, shortening the use. Given how successful they've been, I wonder if that's going to give it more, if it's going to be an easier sell to a front office or higher up in a front office or to an owner to say, hey, this is kind of how we want to structure our pitching staff. Because look, the Astros just won 105 games doing this. White Sox aren't, as far as Lopez is concerned, the White Sox aren't necessarily, or at least they haven't been they've been a pretty slow to adapt or accept new ideas like that, I think. Would be fair to say.
Yeah, and I think the White Sox also have every incentive to leave him in a starting role as long as possible. And the results haven't been great, but they have not been bad. So I think it makes sense the way that they're approaching it with Lopez. The other thing is, I know, you know, Colin introed us, but we did have a note at the end about Luis Robert. And he would be on this list. He was on iterations of this list, and ultimately it came down to, so there were kind of 5. There were like 4.5 prospects on this list. You know, it just came down to us not being comfortable since he has not been stateside, and we don't have the ability to people who have talked to people who have seen him, but we didn't have a good enough look to really represent what he is and what he might be. It would be too much guesswork on our end. So we kind of just said we recognize that, you know, we've heard reports and people feel very strongly about him, and there's a good chance he should be on this list, but we just can't speak to it right now.
So yeah, that's fair enough. I think there is also one. Sorry, Colin. Just one last question I had sort of before we jumped off of that area. Alec Hansen was a guy who moved up from, I think, 97. I know you said reconstruct the list from scratch, but sure. Hansen has certainly been like a big mover from the preseason list to midseason. And I did think, in terms of discussing how much of a jump that would be, I thought it was interesting to talk about how the ordinal gap I suspect it's sort of the gap between these players shrinks the further you get away from one. I mean, the gap yes. between 40 and 80 is probably not nearly as big as it is between one and 40.
That's absolutely correct. Although, it, you know, it does depend on the year and kind of, you know, right now, I mean, we have a whole separate article that Jarrett Seidler wrote that I thought was fantastic about how we landed at number one in Yoan Moncada. I think our gap this year between number one and number seven, we really had a top six because seven is Gleyber Torres and he had a very weird injury that kind of shook him out a little bit further down. But he was in consideration at one point. He was often in the top three in our discussions before the injury. But, you know, one to seven, and I think you could really extend it to nine if you wanted to, are in a tier. And I think there's a pretty hard gap between nine, who is Alex Reyes for us, and 10, who is Lewis Brinson. But in general, the gap between 1 and 10 might be as big as the gap between 40 and 90, just because it's harder to make those small graded, you know, when you get towards the top or to the far right tail, moving that little small gradation is much harder than it is to move in the middle.
Yeah, and you're talking about – you can even see it happening at the back half of the 50 where, you know, especially with the pitchers where you're saying, okay, well, you know, Riley Pint is a guy who has – like there's so much risk there, but there's a lot of, you know, raw ability versus – like at a certain point there's so many –
Pint is a guy. No, go. It's fine. Pint's an interesting guy too because he's someone who came into last year's draft as a potential 1-1 guy, right? And he throws 101 miles an hour, and he's got, you know, he flashes a bunch of pitches, and the command is just non-existent right now. It's tough because I was talking to someone, you know, before the podcast, and I said, you know, there's a chance that if we release this list tomorrow, Riley Pint wouldn't have been on it because we were really honing in on him yesterday and deciding like what we wanted to do with him. And he really hasn't been that impressive right now. And it's a huge project and the upside is immense. The counter argument for him not being on the list and why he is on it is he's probably the last guy on this list who has a roll seven upside. And he's so far away from that upside, but he has it. And the question is, you know, how much do we want to weight that upside? And so he is on it. But again, like I said, if we ran it tomorrow, he might not be in favor of someone who's maybe a little more polished with a little lower upside. But the reality is, like, they're all in a very fluid discussion towards the back end of the list. And regarding Hanson specifically, you know, he's someone who was for a long while behind Riley Pint, behind Forrest Whitley. And the more we talked about him, I mean, he's someone who came into the college season last year as a potential one. Or was it 2 years ago, and bottomed out and ended up going in the second round, right? It's either first supplemental or second.
Yeah, he was in the late – I think he was like the 49th pick overall or
something.
Yeah,
so
like that.
In the top 50 picks. And he's someone, you know, that in our offseason list, since we are referencing that, I mean, I think we were one of the only people, if not the only people, who ranked him in the top 100. And we did so because we were, you know – trying to weigh his longer track record of entering the season as, you know, a potential 1-1 guy. And he bottomed out, like I said, but he showed flashes of that former self after his pro debut. And so we put him on the list, and you could make the argument that we underranked him because if we were confident that he was his former self again, he should be much higher. I mean, you know, first round guys tend to be higher than that, especially college guys who are polished and could move quickly. With Hanson, you know, maybe we weren't that confident and we wanted to see a little more. And now we've gotten, you know, Jarrett and I know Jarrett has seen him. I think Jeff Paternostro has seen him in person, and he's been really good. So that gives us the confidence to kind of give him a little helium and push him up the list in that sense.
Also, there's probably not any pitchers above him who have a better pitch face, right?
I don't think there's a pitcher on the list who has a better pitch face.
So we talk, I mean, yeah, you guys obviously get a lot of credit for, you guys have been on the Hansen bandwagon since pretty much day one, and like you mentioned, higher on them than most other organizations that I've seen. Obviously, he's risen up quite a bit. Kopech has kind of stabilized there, top 20 to 30 range. The one guy who's fallen, who I think most White Sox fans are most concerned about, is Lucas Giolito, who is 31 on the list, has not looked good this year by all accounts. I guess I'm just curious. Obviously, you guys have the concerns over Reynaldo Lopez starting. Where's the concern meter, I guess, on Giolito at this point?
It's pretty high. I mean, the reality is that we look at Lucas Giolito and kind of do the internet shruggy guy. It's I mean, so we have an article coming tomorrow, or at least planned for tomorrow, that Jeff is writing on guys that we just don't really know about. And Giolito is one of the inspirations for that. I mean, there, again, when you talk about kind of reputation and history, you know, Giolito, and I think Jeff wrote this, we only have five OFP8 reports in our eyewitness database, and they're all Giolito. And so, you know, it's not that we want to anchor ourselves to previous evaluations necessarily, but I think when we do keep in mind, you know, a longer history, it's beneficial. And I think that's something that allowed us to be kind of early on guys like Hansen. And it might mean that we're late on getting off guys like Giolito, but he has, I mean, there were stories that the Nationals and where he was last year at AA, that they tinkered with his mechanics and got him away from what he had been successful with. And I saw him for a four-inning start, but it was a bunch of pitches in Bowie when he was with the Nationals last year. And the fastball was only 90 to 94. I think he might have touched 95. The curveball is, I mean, conceptually, it's an incredible pitch. It's a plus-plus offering. I don't think he threw it for a strike once. Like, he generated a bunch of swings and misses with it, but he spiked it a ton, and he got a bunch of he was below the zone with it constantly. I didn't see him throw, you know, drop it in for a strike a single time in that outing. And it's one outing, so I don't want to make too much of that. But the question is, like, that's kind of a raw grade on the curveball, but if he can't throw it for strikes and his velocity is, it's never been what it was pre-surgery, right? Like, he was touching 99, flirting with 100 pre-surgery, and it's been good after that, but not great. You know, so what are you left with? It's kind of a developing changeup, a curveball that he needs guys to swing at. But especially if he's in AAA and going to be in the majors, you know, guys will make him throw it for a strike before they swing at it at some point. And then you're working with what at this point is more of a major league average fastball than something premium. And it's really hard to know how that works out. I think part of the reason we still have him at 31 is he's had some really good starts in AAA too, where it seems like the stuff has been coming back, but it's definitely not consistent. And as I said, you know, before I started this long ramble, when you add that all together, it's kind of like I don't know. I mean, that's we have to be willing to say we don't know, right? And there are a lot of ways this could shake out, but we know that the talent was there at some point, and it's hard to give up on that when you see how good he could have been. And so maybe we're going to be slow on being off Giolito, but he still shows flashes. So it's hard.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, I don't know how much you can do at a certain point other than say, here are the potential paths for him and we'll see which one he goes down. And I don't know how much deference, I don't know how much it goes into your calculus to say, at least as a White Sox fan, or White Sox fans have been able to say, even through bad years, that their pitching development's been pretty great. And I don't know how much deference you give to the fact that, like, okay, well, the Nationals messed with them, it didn't work out, the White Sox are pretty good at this, and let's just toss it over to Dotson and Cooper and see what happens.
Yeah, I think we would like to just have, you know, right now we're working with, you know, a few months of him working with them. So, you know, maybe it's something that takes longer than that to figure out. You know, it's hard to know that type of stuff in terms of development. I mean, and the other half of that whole discussion is that's all as a starter. If he's a reliever and only if he can ramp up the fastball back to, you know, the 97 range and throw the hellacious curveball, you know, maybe he turns into Archie Bradley.
Yeah, and like,
and that's, I mean, you know, Archie Bradley was very close to the level of Giolito, and he didn't pan out as a starter. The command wasn't there. He got hit around too much, and he's flourishing in a bullpen role right now. And you know, this goes back to that Reynaldo discussion. Really valuable when they're really good, but it's harder to find, you know, to know when they're going to be really good and be really good consistently. So, I mean, he does have a decent floor in that sense.
Yeah, and it's interesting too in terms of, and maybe this gets closer to thinking about, like, you know, more of a Tino conversation in terms of fantasy, where you've got like this potential White Sox bullpen where you have like Zach Birdie, Ronaldo Lopez, like Lucas Giolito, and like
Carson Fulmer.
Yeah, and you throw all those, and maybe that's, and you say, well, you know, you whiffed on those guys as starters, but then you have this like in potential for this insane bullpen.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at what was the Royals. I mean, Wade Davis was a failed starter. Kelvin Herrera was kind of, I mean, he didn't get given a great chance to start, but because he's a shorter guy, and you know, I mean, that's those matter. I mean, those are reasonable. Those are not bad outcomes for an organization. But when you're looking at MLB value, it's not going to correlate directly to a list. And if you want to look at prospect lists and say, you know, that's a flaw in the prospect list approach, I mean, that's something I'd certainly say we could talk about. But it's also it's weighting prospect lists, the way that we approach it, at least, are weighting probabilities in terms of impact. And so if we're short, like I've said this three times, but if you're short as a reliever, it's just hard to make up the number of innings that if this guy who we might agree is not going to be a great starter, but if he's throwing a bunch more innings and there's less variability in terms of or variance in terms of his outcomes just because he's throwing more innings over time, you know, we're going to lean towards that direction at this point.
And there's also the fallback element to it too, right? Where like you were talking about the seven guys who were mainly in the discussion for number one. And I can't help but notice that kind of draws the line there right above Eloy. And he's the first guy on here who doesn't play like a premium defensive position. And mm-hmm. that I feel like similarly, if you're talking about someone here, like I'm pretty sure he's a reliever, which means if you're there with a guy and you say, well, what if he doesn't, if he works out worse than expected, where does he go? Because if you bust as a reliever, you're out of baseball, as opposed to if you bust as a starter, you're a reliever.
Yeah, and that's the floor. Like we talk a lot about floors in the prospect community, but the honest reality is, like, if you're talking about a floor for most of these guys, it's out of baseball. But you can't really convey that because it's not really useful, right? Because it applies to so many guys. And I mean, and the other part of it is that when you're talking about a lot of these pitching prospects, I mean, Brent Honeywell might not be, you know, we think he looks like a starter. I think he has a very good likelihood of being a starter if he goes Archie Bradley, but Brent Honeywell, Mitch Keller, Sixto Sanchez, Walker Buehler, all of those guys have phenomenal quote unquote floors as dominant relievers, right? So that's part of the starting pitcher profile a little bit. It's not true with everybody, but with a lot of those guys, especially further up on the list, it is the case.
And Kopech as well, I guess, is in that
group too. Absolutely. I mean, part of the reason Kopech is at 25 is our team particularly thinks he's more of a reliever than he is a starter. The part of the reason he's at 25 despite that, as opposed to the Reynaldo situation, is that if he's a starter, he might be Noah Syndergaard. And that's the stuff that we have to weigh, right? But but the reality is, you know, Kopech is going to be a hell of a reliever if he is a reliever, and there's a chance he's a starter. And if he is, it probably means he's dominant. I mean, that just because of how high octane the stuff is.
I don't know if I think we've touched on all the guys who were either White Sox guys who were on the top 50 or in consideration for it. I mean, is during this time where you're sort of doing the mid-year evaluations, do you guys devote any time to players who are clearly like not on the top 50? I mean, is this something where I don't know, like Dane Dunning or something, someone who I've been interested in. I don't know if there's any time to devote to those types of guys further down in the system.
I had an evaluator make a case to me that Dunning should rank over a guy like Riley Pine. And I don't think it's unfair, but again, that's a ceiling versus floor argument. Dunning has dominated the low minors. He's got a really advanced changeup, and that's going to help you dominate the low minors. But he's very good, you know, and I think he's someone we didn't discuss him a ton for this list, but I think he's, if I had to guess, and again, this is, I don't want, you know, don't quote me on this because it's our process is very collaborative and I rely a lot on our team, but just myself, I'd probably have him in my top 75 if I was listing it out. And as we talked about, the gap between 75 and 50 or 75 and 40 is really, it's not a ton of room.
Yeah. And how much of that again goes back to that philosophical thing where it's like, you know, if I had to bet on Dunning versus Hanson, I have to pick one to make the majors. I think I go Dunning, but because Hanson's been unusably terrible within the last like year and a half, but
sure.
Like then you,
and Dunning has history of relief, which means, you know, if he's used to relieving and that type of role, it's really easy to get relievers to the majors. Right. I mean,
it's so difficult. I mean, I don't know if they're, because there's so much fluidity here, are there any personal, like you said, it's a collaborative effort. This list isn't just like Jeff's top 50 or Jarrett's or yours. Were there guys who, you know, after all the conversation took place that wound up a little lower than if on your personal list, or there are guys who just missed off of your personal list, White Sox or no, who you know, want to take a second to raise or address or say why that.
I mean, we love the White Sox system, right? I mean, I like Zach Collins. I want to see more of Luis Alexander Basabe. I mean, especially Basabe he's a very toolsy guy, and I'm a little bit of a tools whore. and it's just, it's really fun to see those guys, especially if it clicks. You know, I think those two are names that I'm sure readers of the site and White Sox fans are interested in. You know, Collins is a really tough read right now. He's kind of in that shruggy group, just because I think, you know, the White Sox seem to be happy with his defense, but he also hasn't hit kind of like you thought a really polished advanced bat would. And, you know, if that's because he's focusing on his defense and becoming more viable at catcher, I think that's palatable for everyone. I mean, it's the other thing is that, you know, as we put on Carson Kelly's why he might fail on the list, catchers are weird. And it's really true. Like, their development path is so weird. And it was part of the reason that we talked about, we had Francisco Mejia number three, and Jeff made kind of an impassioned case about putting him number one. And the reason for that is catchers are so weird that he's a guy who might have one of the better hit tools in the minors, or does have one of the better hit tools in the minors, is a switch hitter, has average power. And if he's a catcher, I mean, that's insane value, right? And catchers are so weird that if you get that, how is it not kind of the number one guy? You know, my counter argument was also that catchers are weird. And their development, you know, like we've seen so many high end. I mean, Matt Wieters was Mark Teixeira, but a catcher, and he's been pretty valuable over the course of his career. And he's also been a huge letdown from what he was as a prospect.
Right. Like Matt, Mark Teixeira catcher, like Mike Piazza's bat with like a plus glove or something, you know, something crazy like
right.
that.
And so to me, like that the risk of, and this is kind of the positional equivalent to relievers a little bit, right? Is that Mejia's kind of smaller for a catcher, at least in his frame. And if he's not catching 130 games or even 120 games, like what, how does that impact his value? He has fewer opportunities to kind of let his talent shine. And so if he is struck with a down BABIP year or whatever it might be, or if he is going to get nicked up behind the plate because he is kind of a smaller guy, like we have to factor all of that in. And so obviously we put him number three in the minors. We still really like him, but it's really tough for me to make a catcher number one, just because there are so many extra risks that come with being a catcher. Now those risks also have rewards, right? I mean, if you get Buster Posey, you know, you get Buster Posey, but it's tough. And so when we look at a guy like Collins, you know, it could just be, this is kind of a slowdown before he really has it all click. Cause if he starts hitting like everyone expects him to hit and knows he can hit, while also showing a more of a viability behind the plate, you know, that's someone who would be a top 50 prospect pretty easily.
So there's obviously we haven't even brought up Yoan Moncada yet. Maybe there's not a lot that needs to be learned about him at this point. But there's a guy in the middle of your top 50 who isn't a White Sox prospect, but kind of strikes a nerve. Fernando Tatis Jr., who the White Sox traded for James Shields just about 13 months ago. How upset should we be about that trade at this point?
You know, I wouldn't be thrilled with it. And I love Shields, and I think he brings, people are going to hate this, but I really think he brings a lot to a clubhouse, to other players. And I think there's, I know that's like intangible crap that people tend to either poo-poo, or because it's not quantifiable, it's kind of set to the side, and that's not unreasonable. But like, if you go back to the Royals, you can really trace him working with Danny Duffy on like the mental side of pitching and that type of stuff to Duffy's breakout. And there's a lot of value in that. And I think if the Sox start, you know, obviously he was there in spring training with some of these younger guys, but if they start, you know, bringing up some of their AAA arms, or even just have him there with Rodon, there's a lot of value in that, or the potential for value. Obviously it doesn't always work out, and he's not going to connect with everybody the same way, just the same as coaches don't. But I think there's a lot there. I don't think there's enough to necessarily say this was a valid and worthwhile trade, especially when you bring, you know, some of the money into it and that type of stuff. Tatis, you know, I had a pro scout tell me he's a top 15 guy, like a top 20, top 15 guy. We didn't have him quite there. We've had guys on the team who saw him who were not as enamored as kind of the industry is as a whole. But, you know, he's so young. He's, you know, I don't know that he'll be a shortstop, but there are a lot of avenues to success for him, is kind of the way I'd put it. If he sticks as a shortstop, you obviously don't need the hit and the power to be substantial. I think that those tools have the potential to be substantial, in which case, if he's not a shortstop, that's fine. So there are a lot of kind of different paths for him to find success and to reach the majors and be a quality player. And he's someone who the industry in particular was really excited about.
In terms of your, to go a little bit more lighter for the White Sox, because that Tatis, the thing with trading a prospect away for a veteran where it like really doesn't work out on the field is it like, it stings for forever, because like the prospect comes up and they're good for like a while. And
especially with prospect lists and the fetishization of prospects and all of that. I mean, like, we learn about these guys so early. I mean, the other thing is, you have to, it's fair to judge this stuff in hindsight in some respects, but you know, at the time, some people thought, you know, that Tatis was going to be on this track and that he was going to be really, really good. Others were kind of like, you know, he's light years away from the majors. And this is, you know, those are the decisions you make sometimes when you go for it. And you sacrifice, you make those decisions understanding, you know, this could bite us. But we view it as worth it at the time. Obviously it hasn't played out that well, but that way. But, you know, there's also a version of events where even, you know, even if you get the same shields, Tatis spends, you know, 3 years in short season in A-ball rather than crushing A-ball immediately.
Yeah, and you, I feel like certainly this year's been a bit of a, personally for me, a bit of a reminder to not necessarily give up on guys too early, even though I try, you know, you try to balance that with the idea that most of these prospects are going to fail, and the further you get from the majors, that likelihood increases exponentially. But then, you know, as certainly with at the major league level, where you have like Lurie Garcia and Avisaíl and stuff like that, all of a sudden looking like major leaguers again, yeah. Or guys like, I don't know, Logan Morrison looks amazing all of a sudden at his at age what, like 31. So I don't know if maybe those are two sort of ideas to try to hold in mind at the same time. As I mean, Mick Rodolfo is like all of a sudden looking like he might not be got, you know, abandoned hope just yet as well. So yeah.
Still just 20. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you go back, I mean, you can go to other systems, but you know, we just had a 10 pack on Jacob Gatewood, who's a big prep prospect, out of the draft, ended up going, I think in the supplemental first round to Milwaukee, looked terrible for several, I think we're in the third or fourth year of his career, and he's still at high A. I mean, which is, again, age-wise, that's fine. He was a prep guy. But he's gone from shortstop to third to first in the meantime while not hitting. And all of a sudden this year, part of the story, at least this year, is that he got corrective lenses or corrective surgery for his eyes. But he's now back as a – I mean, look, he's not on this list. He's not a top 100 guy in all likelihood, but he's alive again. I mean, you know, for all intents and purposes, last year you would have said, no, he's dead. Like, you know, you don't even have to think about his name. But you do now. I mean, there's some modicum of value there. And so this is all – you know, it's hard – and I don't think necessarily beneficial to always take the long view, but you do have to factor it in along with kind of the more immediate future.
And I guess that in defense of you, you know, you kind of joked that you're a sucker for tools, but the thing with guys like Gatewood and Adolfo, and I even remember this listening to podcasts about, you know, talking about Jake Gatewood before that draft, where he was in consideration as like a top 10 or top 15 pick at the time.
At one point he was, and then he was selling out for power on the showcase circuit and swinging him. Yeah, but yes.
Right, but you get these guys who have this, like, you know, massive raw power or something like that, and they can make you look ridiculous because they might go Courtney Hawkins on you. But, like, I don't know if they ever do figure out how to just get their freaking bat on the ball, like, they can make you look pretty smart too. I guess it's just,
yeah. And part of at least my approach on this stuff is like, I, you know, and again, we're getting a little far afield from White Sox specific, but when you talk about looking at prospects one of the major things that Pakoda brought to the table as a predictive, you know, algorithm is that it has a longer history than humans. Like just the way that humans function, we don't do great with longer histories, right? Like, we don't keep them as fresh in our minds and weight them the way that necessarily would be beneficial for making predictions. And so that's part of, and this is more my specific approach and not necessarily the BP prospect team as a whole, but I try and give credence to that history a little longer than other people might. And as I said before, and as I've said before in general, you know, that might mean that I'm slow to pick up on a pop-up guy. And it might mean that I'm slow to get off a guy who just has lost it. But I think there are a lot of cases where it's serves us well to remember that stuff and realize that, like, the, you know, 3 months performance doesn't, you know, validate or invalidate everything that came before it.
Yeah. And I think Hansen's such a, you know, we talked about before, such a great example of that, where, you know, you're talking about a guy who was what, at age 20 or something like that, had a really lost his command for 3 months or something like that. And he lost in spectacular fashion, but now that you've got another year of data at the pro level, the more that compiles, the more that those months look like an aberration. And that's why the White Sox were able to get him with their third pick instead of with having to burn their first or not having to even be there at 10.
And beyond that, I mean, that's all at a very meta level too. If you want to get into the granular, you know, you say, why did he lose his mechanics? Like, is it something with him? Is it something that he, you know, he didn't care? Was it hiding an injury? You know, all of those things, any of those things can come into play. And if you know why and you know it's fixable, then you want to wait that previous performance a little more. If you don't know why, you know, maybe you want to be a little more cautious, and that's reasonable.
And Jose Quintana is a guy who has basically like photocopied the exact same season for like 3 or 4 years now at the major league level. And it came off a really rough start to this season. And it's starting to look like there was a mechanical issue with him not finishing his curveball and he was leaving it up. And now in the last 5 or 6 starts, knock on wood, it looks like he's sort of corrected that. And he's kind of right back to the Jose Quintana that we saw for 4 years. I have to imagine with minor, and that's a guy who's like robotic in his mechanics. So, you know, multiply that times 1,000 for however many amateurs and minor leaguers.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And that's why it gets really boring and aggravating to be the guy griping about people overreacting to small samples. But that's exactly why you don't overreact to small samples.
Yeah. Cool.
So
yeah, Colin, you're here.
I am here. You know, Nick is so good at carrying the conversation, and I just woke up like an hour ago. So, you know, I just let him go.
Colin, you're either burning me super hard and super politely, like a veteran of Versailles or something.
No, like that. No. you take that as a backhanded compliment, but honestly, it's like you're just having a conversation with Craig, and I'm enjoying listening to it.
This is a lot of what our conversations are like in person.
Yeah. Well, we've gone about 45 minutes right now, and we've barely talked about the number one prospect on your list. And maybe it's because Moncada is probably the least contentious prospect among the top 50 possibilities on the White Sox. But I guess I'm just curious, is there anything that we've seen out of Moncada in the last 3.5 months that's taught us anything that we didn't already know before?
Not for me. And that might not be a super exciting answer, but it's kind of the same questions with the same really good result. And he flashes the same, unbelievable tools. And basically at this point, I just want to see him at the major league level and see what he can do against the best performance or the best opponents that he can face. The swing and miss is still a concern, but I don't know that he's going to do anything in particular to change that when he's still experiencing a lot of success in the upper minors. And, you know, I kind of want to see, obviously it was out of hand in his brief run, when he jumped straight from AA last year with the Red Sox. I'd like to see what he does now that he's had more AAA time. And basically, if he keeps getting exploited that badly, I want to see how he adjusts to it. But I don't know that he needs to do – he needs to make those adjustments despite all the swing and miss, at AAA. So it's just a situation where I'm kind of hoping that they bring him up and that – We get to see what he can do, because I don't know that we're learning a ton at this point.
Is the there was some question at least early on in his minor league career about what position he was going to ultimately play. The White Sox have him stuck at second base. You know, the Red Sox were trying him at third base. Do you think second base is probably the best fit for him long term?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think he could be a pretty good defender in center if he wanted to be, even though he's got like a really thick body, but he can run. I mean, it's weird to see someone with like kind of a linebacker style body move that fast. But he'd probably be fine in center. I think second works. I don't think the defensive gap between second and center is as big as sometimes it's made out to be. And I think I think he'd be an above average second baseman defensively. I really don't think he's going to have a problem there. And I know people who I talked to over the off season, so it's a little out of date, but I know people who saw him a bunch over the off season said he's going to be just fine at second. I think, you know, the Red Sox with third base, that was kind of more of a by necessity. type of thing.
They didn't really have anywhere else to play him if they wanted to call him up.
Right.
Is there any reason at this point for the White Sox? I mean, you mentioned the swing and miss, but at the beginning of the year, it was like, oh, well, maybe they're manipulating service time, and then he got hurt and kind of slumped. Is there any discernible good reason why he's not with the White Sox at this point?
They might have really good reasons. I don't know them. That's not shade. I mean, I think it's funny because, you know, I can get these questions, but, you know, you could ask these questions directly to them. I think, you know, a very viable answer is we have a plan for him. You know, we want him to check off 10 different boxes, and he's at 8 right now. And when he checks off those last two, he'll be up. And, you know, to me, that's a very viable response. Yeah. And, you know, that could be anything from, and again, this is not person specific, but it could be from showing up to meetings on time to, you know, being, you know, incredibly focused during ground ball drills versus, you know, to cutting down on, you know, they want to see tangible improvement in his contact rates. You know, it could be any number of things. And if he hasn't done all of them, then, you know, as an organization, it's very reasonable to me to say, you know, we have to enforce what our, you know, we don't want to call him up unless there's a dire situation at the major league level until he does these things, because we need our players to know we're serious about how they develop, and when they do those things, they will get promoted, and we can assure them of that. And that creates buy-in to their whole system. You know what I mean? So I think that's a possibility. I don't know what those things would be. So from the outside, I think, you know, I'm seeing someone who strikes out a lot. That's really the biggest flaw there. And I think the White Sox are in a place where they can trot him out as an improvement, even with those struggles.
Yeah, and it's almost like if, you know, especially with the team not trying to contend, it's like if you even have like a 1% doubt that he's ready for the major leagues, what's the point in bringing him up? Because you're not trying to win, and maybe he'll improve your ball club, but that doesn't matter to you at this point.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is it looked like for a while he might actually force the issue, because he was, I think, like May, there was a stretch where he was hitting like 350 or something, and his strikeout rate was dropping from above 30 into like the mid-20s. Then obviously the injury happened and he slumped, so that kind of buys you some time from a pure baseball standpoint to just say, well, let's see if he can keep consolidating those gains. And this may sound silly because of who it is, but you look at the White Sox Major League roster, and, you know, you are trying to showcase Frazier to trade him, and Yolmer Sanchez has gone from a guy who, you know, looked like he might not be a major league at all to someone who might actually be a viable part of your team moving forward. And it's not necessarily a bad thing to have those guys playing every day. And you certainly don't want to call up Moncada for a timeshare. So you have weeks
that's,
at least.
That's the other part of it organizationally. I mean, you talk about Yolmer Sanchez, and, you know, you might say you shouldn't let a Yolmer Sanchez stand in the way of a Yoan Moncada, and that's probably true. Yeah. But if you developmentally have said to Sanchez, we need you to do X, Y, and Z things to be successful and to earn a starting role, and he's done those things, and then you immediately replace him with a prospect, you know, that's gonna cause a problem.
Yeah, especially with someone who's like an Uber prospect who's got a huge signing bonus, who's still, you know, striking out a lot. I mean, you could, it's not a Chris Bryant thing where, oh, we're leaving him down for a week to, quote, work on his defense. I mean, Moncada's OPS in AAA is 830 something right now. It's not.
It's good.
He hasn't mastered the level.
Sure. I mean, and that's the, but, you know, that's the other thing, is that if, you know, all your players watch how you treat everyone else. And if you tell Sanchez he needs to do X, Y, and Z to be a starter, and then he does those things and he's currently a starter, and you then promote Moncada when he hasn't done the last two things on his checklist, you know, as a hypothetical, you know, other guys are going to start to pay attention and say, yeah, well, they notice how they treat everybody. You know what I mean? And so you want to be as consistent as you can be. And there are always going to be situations where you have to deviate. But, you know, you want to make sure that you can explain that and be as consistent as possible. And so it could be one of those. It could also just be, you know, they're approaching it in a way that I wouldn't, and that happens too.
And by all accounts, Yolmer is like beloved in that clubhouse. But
here's just a quick a quick tangent, but I think it's relevant. So we just had the Baseball Prospectus Mets event last week or around 10 days ago. So, and
oh, it broke my heart to miss it.
I know. Well, so one of the things Sandy Alderson said there when someone asked him about promoting Rosario, who's our number two prospect and in not much of a dissimilar situation to Moncada, and this is something he had said to the press, so I'm not breaking news here, but he said to this crowd of about 75 people, he said, if the team is going really well, we're not going to bring him up because the team is going really well. And if the team isn't going really well, we're not going to bring him up because we don't want the weight of the world to be on his shoulders or for him, people to view him as a savior. And that's a weird thing to hear someone say because it doesn't really leave a lot of room for him to come up. But yeah. But I say that to illustrate the point that sometimes MLB org's approaches are just different.
Yeah, and the Mets, I guess it's like I guess that's the sort of liberating aspect of the White Sox just conceding the season in wins and losses before it starts versus the Mets who very, you know, for very understandable reasons saw themselves as a contender. And it's been weird to watch them, their season looking like it's, you know, sinking into the ocean where you have this massive hole and this guy who looks ready to fill it. Sitting at AAA and you're just thinking like, you know, why are they not, you know, break glass in case of emergency? Like, why are they not doing this? But I guess, I mean, these are people and it's really hard. These are human beings.
It's all very, very hard.
I do think I'm actually running a little short on time. We have a couple of questions from our listeners. I do want to touch on this because it seems like sort of topical and it sort of fits a lot of the different areas we've been touching on. The Nationals bullpen is this sort of like screamingly obvious talking point in terms of the trade deadline approaching. And the White Sox are obviously a pretty natural fit for a partner here. We've had a lot of readers and a lot of people, and it's, you know, it's understandable wishful thinking where they're like, oh, like what about like Robles or Soto? And I think those guys are pretty clearly, as you look at this mid-season list, I think it should be pretty clear that those are not guys that you're moving for relievers, no matter how valuable a window this season is for the Nationals. I mean, you have a slam dunk championship caliber team with one massive hole. But at the same time, I mean, knowing the national system certainly better than I do beyond those two names, are there guys who look like there'd be interesting prospects that might be of the quality that would be moved for a reliever like a Robertson or, you know, a rental guy who's looking quite strong like a Swarzak or even maybe a premium long-term asset like a Canely. Are there fits there in that national system? Again, with the caveat too, that like prospect trades are really weird. Reliever markets are really weird and so on.
Yeah. I mean, you and I have talked about the Soto Robles thing before. I think, you know, and, guy, you know, general managers can differ and might just want to go for it. And in that case, they pony up. But I think my general answer is that rather than move one of those guys for a huge package, they would just trade off multiple lower end pieces and try and patch the gap because relievers are weird. And, you know, you can, you know, get a guy for relatively cheap and have him be dominant for a 10 inning stretch throughout the playoffs and he can make all the difference. You know what I mean? And so sometimes teams just don't want to pay for, I mean, you know, the Cubs won the World Series, but, you know, are they going to regret trading Gleyber Torres for Aroldis Chapman? I mean, you know, they might in a long-term sense. They're never going to regret winning the World Series, but, you know, in a long-term sense, it's a real question. To answer your question more specifically, yeah, I mean, there are definitely – the Nationals have guys further down. I mean, Carter Kaboom was their first rounder last year. He's very good. He's been hurt for a while. I saw him. He was very good. He's probably not a shortstop, but he has the bat to profile elsewhere. I mean, that Hagerstown team has kind of a lot of talent on it, and it's all recently drafted. But you have Carter Kaboom, Blake Perkins. We just had a 10-pack on him from my alter ego, Greg Goldstein. he's he's really interesting. He's kind of a leadoff type offensive offensively and a center fielder. He's smaller, but a switch hitter. He's really interesting. Daniel Johnson, he's 22, but he is really hitting at low A. I've had people tell me he has at least 3+ tools with like 70 speed being one of them. The question is, you know, is he going to hit more than a fringe guy? I know one evaluator thinks he has the potential to be an above average hit guy. And if you think that he's a real steal and he's down at Hagerstown and might be discounted because of an age relative to level thing. I mean, Sheldon Noisy is down at Hagerstown too. He's kind of he's an infield guy. He's not a shortstop. He might not be much of a third baseman. He's probably more of a utility guy. But again, those, you know, when you're talking about second, third, fourth guys in deals, you know, they have value. And I think he's probably a decent bet to be a major leaguer. In the upper levels, I mean, Eric Fetty is probably the biggest name. He was a candidate for the top 50. They had converted him to a reliever because they were talking about just plugging him in as a potential solution. But they've recently put him back out as a starter or transitioning him back to starting. And I, you know, my speculation on that would be that they're auditioning him for trades. And he was a first round pick a few years ago, had Tommy John. He was like a top 10 guy that they got in the teens because he had Tommy John.
So he's been really good. Again.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, and it's their playbook but even this year they got Seth Romero at huge value. And that's because not because he had Tommy John, but because he's a bit of a head case and got kicked off his college team. But that's a top 10 talent that they got at like 22nd or whenever they picked. So, I mean, that's right out of their playbook, but certainly, you know, Eric Fetty, I think, is probably the top name. He's already 24. I think he can go into a rotation, you know, really pretty quickly. He developed a curveball this year in addition to his fastball slider change, and his slider can be a bat misser. His fastball is good enough. I mean, I think it's probably above average. It's not stellar, but you know, it's fine, especially with the quality of the slider, and the curve could get to be, you know, an average or above pitch too, and the change is right around. So he's a pretty big repertoire to work with. So I think he would be the top name in that sense. And then if you want to go further down, like a guy as a throw-in who they might – I know they value relatively highly, but who teams would probably want as a second or third piece, like a valuable second or third piece, is a guy down way down named Jesus Luzardo. So I know I just rattled off a bunch of names. It's not going to mean stuff to a ton of people, but yeah, they have those secondary pieces that are not Soto and Robles to get a deal done and to get a deal that would be probably amenable to White Sox or other teams, obviously, if they're involved with them.
No, I think that was exactly what I was looking for, because it's so people know people who check in on prospects. Some of them might only know, you know, the names on the top 50, the midseason top 50, for example.
For
but
sure.
that doesn't mean those guys are, especially guys they were super high end like Robles and Soto, like that's not really a fit. And I mean, hey, if the Nationals go bonkers and give up Robles for David Robinson, like I don't need to analyze that for you.
Sure. That's yeah. Like and it's not, you know, those things, like you do see those trades, right? I mean, that was kind of a Beltran for Wheeler trade, if you want to pick an older one, right? Like it wasn't for a reliever, but like, or, you know, again, you go back to the Cubs last year. They got Aroldis Chapman, and he's better than Dave Robertson. But the Cubs gave up a top, like, we have a guy as a top 10 guy right now. So, you know, you do see those trades for relievers. And it just depends, you know, it depends if the White Sox were going to eat money. It depends. There are a lot of factors, you know what I mean? So I would personally not do that if I were Rizzo. But, you know, that doesn't mean it can't happen.
Yeah, and the urgency is definitely there. Like I said, I mean,
sure.
you got Harper for two more years. You have Scherzer in his prime. Like,
you have Strasburg being healthy right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, there's a lot of reason to not go into the playoffs with like Matt Albers as your closer. And they need like
all the reasons in the world.
They need more than just a, it's not just, oh, trade for a closer. I mean, like, this isn't a fantasy bullpen. Like, you need you're going to need guys who can come in the 6th, 7th, and 8th, too.
Right, and it's also the cascading effect, right? Like, if you get a 9th inning guy, then your previous – or if you get two guys, right, that are now your 9th and 8th inning guy, the guy who was your 9th inning guy, Albers, is now your 7th inning guy. And that makes you much – you know, that takes you from a bottom 10 bullpen to, you know, probably right outside the top 10. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge jump, you know?
Yeah, and even having, like – Swarzak's not a sexy name, but like having a guy who's vacillated between shutdown and an average this year,
he'd be the best reliever in the Nats bullpen pretty easily.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean probably Kota Glover when healthy, but right. He's not healthy. So
exactly.
So I'm Colin. I don't know if you had anything else. We had a couple questions from the readers, which I thought were pretty.
I was looking for those. Where did you see them?
I got two on Twitter. I have them here.
They're tweeted at you.
There's one that's
all about Nick.
Yeah, I'm glad we could get to that point too here today.
let's expand on that.
Yeah, one question is like a very real prospect question, which comes from Paul Riker. I don't think it's the actual Star Trek character. I suspect, but he asks.
He Googles a lot of stuff. Riker Googling is a.
He asks, what are some of the contributing factors to Jordan Guerrero, I assume, success? And will that translate to success in the majors? What challenges would he have? And I think, Craig, you mentioned you'd actually seen Jordan Guerrero.
It was a bit ago, certainly. But yeah, I have seen him. I mean, this was at a time when everyone was hyped up on the Spencer Adams train, and I had a scout. And again, you know, the thing is, you have a scout who will tell you a lot of things, right? So it's, you know, take it for what it's worth. But I had a scout tell me he preferred Guerrero to Adams at the time, and that was when Adams was kind of a rising star. Guerrero is the obstacles he faces are that he doesn't throw that hard. Fortunately, he is left-handed. I mean, it's just a back-end profile, and the margins are really slim. I think what helps him is that, you know, his command has probably taken a bit of a step forward, and he's been able to keep guys off balance with sequencing and location. And those guys, you know, sometimes those guys, you know, act that way all the way up. Other times that those small changes in talent level that they're facing make all the difference in the world, and it means that they're not even a starter. And I don't know if he's someone who has enough even in the tank if he went to relief that it would be that big a difference for him. The obstacles are that the margins are thin, but he's certainly been really good thus far this year. He is repeating double A a bit, and he is 23. I think that's a nice arm to have in your system, as a potential option. I would assume he gets to the majors.
Yeah, I mean he's got shiny-ish stats in double A this year. I mean he's listed at 6'3". He's left-handed. Those are all strengths. The organization, like we talked about earlier, has had success with lefties who don't have huge arsenals in the past. Yep. As well. He's
change up first guy, which those you don't see a ton of success in the majors. I mean, you can when it's an elite change up and there's also a fastball. His fastball's pretty fringy. So
yeah, and that's like when you talk about not having that bullpen as a fallback because you can't. Like, I don't see how you use him as a loogie if he's already washed out as a back end starter. I mean, you know,
right. And if the changeup is his out pitch, like he's a lefty who would need to face righties more. And it's a weird profile for a bullpen.
But he's kept the ball in the park, especially this year, and he doesn't walk a lot of guys, especially this year. So you know, it's
yeah. I mean, he's someone who you know, if he was going to be in the bullpen, maybe you see if he can find a slider. To use against lefties and just, you know, pound lefties in terms of handedness, just take advantage of that and then use to break out the change against righties. But it's the margin for error is pretty slim there.
But there's a path to being a solid, like, fifth starter. Or
sure. I mean, you see those guys. Yeah, you see those guys. Absolutely. I mean, you know, but the other part of it is, do you remember, this might be going a little bit too far, but there was and I'm going to blank on the last name, but it's Edouard either Ramirez or Cabrera, was like this uber change-up guy, I think with the Rockies at some point, and he got traded. And he with the Yankees at one point, yeah. And I think he led the minors in strikeouts one year, and people got really excited about it. But the problem was that, like, that's it. That's all it was. It was a changeup.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's tough. I mean, you look at another guy change up first, like Alex Claudio with the Rangers this year, who's actually having a pretty good year. But he was a guy I saw, they had him in high A at 24. Like, they had demoted him. Like, they basically just used him as a guy to plug in different bullpens. And, you know, and now he's in the majors, but he's got an incredible change up. But he's a low arm slot lefty, so that lets him kind of be the loogie that Guerrero might not have that angle and that slot to attack lefties with right now.
And it's an extreme example, but post-injury, John Danks was lifeless fastball with a plus change from the left side. And, you know, he was – I love John Danks. He was scrappy as hell, and he was always working to try to eke out whatever he could. But, like, that's how that can look also. I think, Colin, did you want to throw in anything else on Mr. Guerrero?
No, I think that we're probably good to call it, huh?
One last very important question, because Craig, one of the best, probably the best work that he does is...
I would agree with this.
He and Ben Carsley do the names draft for the amateur draft, the best names in that the incoming class. And we have a question from a regular listener, Dank Zombie Nickel. Tavern on Twitter asked, what is your favorite name in the White Sox system?
I have an opinion on this. I want to hear Craig's answer first.
Can I just say it's not like a super great system for names. I'm a little usually you find like a lot of, like, at least especially in the lower end guys, like you find interesting enough names, but the I'm not seeing a ton that jumps out to me. I'm going to throw out two names. I think Thaddeus Lowry, you know, you just get the rich guy vibe from that name.
Sounds Thaddeus very legal.
You know, I think, you know, maybe a little bit of a lacrosse bro to it.
Yeah, he's really not happy that you're at the country club with him.
Yeah, exactly. And I same goes for like a Tanner Banks or even a Dane Dunning. I mean, you get the alliteration. It's a pretty fun name to go with. I think my favorite might be Game of Thrones character Brandon Easterling.
Oh, that's a good,
Sebi Zavala is my guy.
Yeah, Sebi Zavala is good.
It sounds like someone starting to say a word and then they just have a stroke mid-sentence. Sebi Zavala.
I think Sebi Zavala is almost hurt by the fact that he is still like kind of a – he's kind of like a fringe prospect. I feel like the best name guys – I feel like they get bonus points to me if they're clearly just org depth. Whereas like – because like the best – maybe the best name the White Sox ever had in their system, and sadly he's not in anymore, which is, you know, you lose – any system loses to graduations, and, you know, sometimes that's just what happens. Storm Throne was
amazing. That was tough. That was a tough loss.
So going
– also Game of Thrones character.
I like Jason Fry too.
Yeah.
I think – yeah, I just saw – Yasmer Solorzano. I mean, you know.
Oh, they've got some crazy ones down in like the AZL.
The two guys I picked out are – they have a couple Venezuelan teenage catchers who I'd never heard of before. There's Ulysses Martinez, U-L-I-S-E-S. And I don't know how to pronounce this at all. I think it's Jonaker Betancourt. So those are –
that's pretty good.
Those are being carried by their first names. Obviously, you know, Betancourt and Martinez are classics. But
yeah, it's tough. It's tough because you do want at least some flow. Yeah, I mean, you definitely want both, and there's sometimes a flow issue there, which I think, you know, there are some, yeah, that's why I kind of like Yasmer or Yosmer Solorzano. Like, there's a little bit of a flow to it.
And I guess,
I mean, there's also Yoandro, but it's J-H-O-A-N-D-R-O, Jorge Alfaro's brother.
Yeah, I was going to bring him up. I was trying to find his first name. I couldn't remember what it was.
Yes. No, I mean, also, I should point out, I don't want to let it go to waste. He was one of the top picks in the name draft that we did. Jake Berger.
Oh, of course.
He's a Craig Goldstein certified beefy boy, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that is 100% correct.
His body fits his name so well.
Yeah, I mean that's part of it too. Is it doesn't always have to be that way, but when you're a beefy guy named Jake Berger, it plays up.
If he was like a short, fast center fielder, it wouldn't be as great.
Yeah, if he was a short, fast center fielder named Jake Berger, it's all potential at that point.
They do have a fast center fielder's last name is Booker, which is kind of nice, which is pretty good. It's pretty known.
But when you're already, I mean, just out it's of God, a minute, yeah, I'm gonna go over to the Red Sox, who I know have like just a cornucopia of of names in their system, especially at the lower levels. There's a guy named Tucker Tubbs. Who's a first baseman down in low A for them. They have Jagger Rusconi.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Who drafted Jeter Downs?
Jeter Downs is great. I mean, that was Ben Carsley's first overall pick for the Reds.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just the Greenville drive alone. They have Tucker Tubbs and Jagger Rusconi. Their pitching staff has Darwinzon Hernandez.
Ooh.
And also Hildemaro Requena.
I mean, this is
all just one team. That's before we get to Edgar Jimenez.
Edgar?
Yeah, it's Edgar with a D.
That's genius. Name, that's kind of Game of Thronesy, almost.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely.
And the first name, I mean, I don't think George R. R. Martin has represented the Latino community very well in his books. But I will say the draft, you know, we talked about Jake Berger. The first two picks, big infusion there because, you know, obviously Jake Berger as like a primo beefy boy just right out of the gate. You know, you could plug him in as a beefy boy from day one.
Yep,
and then in tandem with Thad Lowry, I mean, Gavin Sheets is probably high-fiving Thad Lowry after his sick burn.
He and who was – who's the other name? Tanner Banks, Thad Lowry, and he are just, you know, forming a clique at the club.
They're stuffing you with caviar.
And there's, I guess, Skoug as well. Is just for being weird. Great. I feel great about all of this.
Aren't we overdue, Nick? Don't you gotta be somewhere?
I have to be somewhere in 3 minutes, which is like 15 minutes away. but I can't.
You're welcome.
Because Craig is the best. Love having you on. Thanks for taking the time with us.
Absolutely, Craig.
Thanks for having me, and happy to do it anytime.
And all CD right. Goldstein on Twitter, for whatever reason you don't already follow him.
Yeah, don't follow. It's a bad idea.
Thanks, man.